everyone. This is Erica, your host, and you're listening to Mind the Meds. With this being our very first episode, I want to take some time to really introduce Neurology Pharmacy to anyone who might come across this podcast. With that, I have two of my talented fellow neurology pharmacists with me. I want to thank you both for being here so much. We are recording this actually in person, which is a real treat because even though we work all at the same institution and all specialize in neurology, it's actually really rare to be in the same physical location. So this has been really exciting. And with that, why don't we start with a brief introduction? Who are you and where do you practice? Let's start with you, Tyler.
I'm Tyler Kinney. I'm an inpatient pharmacist here at the University of Utah. I work in both the neurocritical care unit and the neuroacute care unit with our neurology and neurosurgery services.
Awesome. Thanks, Tyler. And you, Sarah?
Hi. My name is Sarah Dehoney, and I'm Erica's cohort. There are two neurology clinics, and I work at the other one. So the patients I see are a little bit different, but we do share some patients.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to answer these questions too because I want you guys to get to know me as well. Like Sarah said, we are both outpatient neurology pharmacists. I work in the other neurology clinic, and we are kind of split based on specialty, although there's some overlap between the two. So between the both of us, I figure we'll have most things covered. Now, I recognize the path to neurology pharmacy doesn't always follow a straight line, as in there isn't a strong pipeline yet from PGY1 to PGY2 neurology to neurology practice. So I think we should all share how we first became interested in neurology, or if not interested in neurology, interested in these positions specifically, you know, like our origin stories, so to speak. And let's start with you, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks, Erica. So roll back to, I did a pharmacotherapy residency. So a PGY1 and PGY2 that included an outpatient component for the whole 2 years. I had a half day of clinic. And so I was practiced in both doing inpatient and outpatient. I did ER for a while and needed a pivot and a change. And so I was looking for an outpatient position among others. And the neurology position definitely was interesting to me because it's something I didn't know a ton about. And so I've been in this position for about 10 years and enjoying it.
Cool.
Great. So I completed actually just a PGY1 residency, and I had an interest in critical care and emergency medicine. And so early on, I actually started in the burn unit and then quickly transitioned into the emergency department. I spent several years there and was really interested in how we can improve care when patients who had neurologic emergencies, things like stroke, seizures, and our traumatic brain injury patients. And that interest really took shape around the same time as the emergency neurological life support started coming out from the Neurocritical Care Society. And then just so happened after a few years after that, I had the opportunity to join a dedicated neurology and neurosurgery team here in Utah, and it offered me a bit more work-life balance. So I made the move almost 10 years ago now. And so here I am.
Very cool. I did not know that about you, Tyler. And as far as me, you know, I love this because we all have very different stories of how we got here. So I actually did a PGY1, PGY2 combined health system pharmacy administration and leadership residency, which is not your common path to clinical practice in general, but certainly not to not a direct line to neurology at all. But I was very upfront when I started residency that clinical practice was what I wanted to do at the end of this. And so I did the structure of the residency was that the PGY1 was just your straight acute care residency, all the same requirements. And so I completed that. And then I made sure that clinical care was a focus in my PGY2 as well. Similar to Sarah, I did a half day in internal medicine clinic throughout my PGY2 year, which is not something I don't think that any of the HSPA residents have done before me or probably after me either. But it was really cool to be the pharmacist in that space and be the only pharmacist in that space for that half day a week. And it got me really interested in that outpatient care side of things. And when residency was coming to an end, you know, I was alerted to this role. There wasn't currently a pharmacist in the clinic. And I think creating a practice is really a leadership skill that goes unnoticed, but a lot of pharmacists actually tap into with their first positions out of residency or out of school. And so I definitely could use those skills and started my practice. And Sarah and I actually started at the same time. So I've also been in clinic for about 10 years now. And yeah, that's how we all got here. So very, very different stories, but all taking care of similar patient populations at this point. And now I want to switch and I'll start off with this question. But the question is, what do you think makes pharmacy involvement so meaningful in your space? And I'll start this one off and just say that neurology is just such a unique combination of complex patients, complex disease states, and complex medication regimens. And so when you have that trifecta, it's really so essential that a pharmacist, I believe, is part of the team. And it makes our interventions, it makes our interactions with the team and with patients very meaningful and very impactful. So I'll just stop there and let Tyler take over from there.
Sure. So I think from an inpatient perspective, a lot of my job really comes down to cost avoidance and prevention. And so in neurology, we work with a lot of the high cost and high risk medications. And the pharmacist really helps ensure consistency and accuracy and safe use of those therapies. So in my role, a big focus is distinguishing what truly requires use inpatient versus what can be transitioned safely to the outpatient setting. Beyond that, I spend a lot of time educating patients, not just on their medications, but how to navigate the healthcare system while they are on new complex or specialty therapies. So without that level of pharmacy involvement, I think many patients are at risk of falling through the cracks, and particularly during transitions of care, I think we play a key role in identifying those gaps and making sure our patients are set up for success.
Well said. And Sarah, how about you?
I think Tyler gave me the perfect segue because where he leaves off, I pick up, right? Erica and I both pick up because the patients need access to very expensive meds. And so we help navigate programs and copay cards and assistance funds and patient liaisons from pharma to help get the medications that are appropriate for the patient at the right time and continuing on those medications. So I think that's one of the things I do besides your standard clinical pharmacy is patient access.
Absolutely. So I feel like we've actually all touched on this. We've all been in our roles for a similar amount of times, just a short decade. You know, there's obviously a reason for that. What's something about neurology that you feel keeps this area of pharmacy so interesting? Let's go back to you, Sarah.
I think for neurology has grown a lot in the 10 years I've been doing it. It used to be thought of as, you know, why would you want to go into neurology? You can't really help people. There aren't meds or things. And that's just entirely not true anymore. So we have a lot more things we can do, and it's getting more complex by the day. So that's something that keeps it really interesting to me.
What about from the inpatient side?
I think a big part of why myself and others have stayed in the neurology space for so long is that it doesn't stand still. There's a constant push to advance care. There's new therapies, new strategies, and ongoing research to try and answer questions when we have patients who really just don't fit neatly into a textbook. I've had a neurologist I work with closely tell me that neurology is about 90% bread and butter cases. You know exactly what to do, and it's just 10% of it is just trying to figure out in real time what you're going to do. And that's really what attracts me the most, is waiting for those patients to come through and see how I can help. But I think, just like Sarah mentioned, you know, neurology is advancing, and stroke care is an example. The number of trials that have come out in the last 10 years have changed the way we practice. We've gone from, we used to call strokes, and we would say neurology is going to come shake their bottle of aspirin down the hallway. And now there's much more we can do. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think these guys hit the nail on the head, but how I used to describe it, and I think it's still applicable now, is that there's just still a lot left to figure out in neurology. I feel like and I'm not dissing on, I'm definitely like a 90s child, I'm not dissing other specialties, but there's kind of like a lot of fine tuning, I feel like, happening in other spaces, whereas neurology, we're like actually still figuring things out. And there's still like diseases that are getting their very first FDA approved medications coming out. And so that is really cool to me. And we'll actually talk about some of those potential advances today. But let's wrap up our kind of overview of neurology pharmacy. What would you say or do to, or not say, what would you say to learners that are interested in neurology and pursuing this area of practice? Tyler, what would you say?
I think one thing is to not get discouraged by the fact there's not many neuro-specific residencies. Those are still relatively limited, but there are a lot of residencies that have a strong neurology experience built in. So that's important for the learners to ask questions about what opportunities are available, both inpatient and outpatient, and how much ownership, have them ask how much ownership they'll have in those neurology patients. Those conversations can tell you a lot about how committed programs are to developing your skill set.
Yeah. What about you, Sarah? Anything to add?
I think that you have to ask. And so, for example, I didn't realize there was a prison clinic that was done through telehealth, you know, 9 years ago. And I wondered what an attending was doing every Thursday morning. And so I went and asked, and I was like, do you mind if I sit in? And now I'm part of that clinic. And so I think you just, even if they're, you're, you know, breaking new ground, you just have to ask. I think, especially in academic medicine, people are very willing to include pharmacists or pharmacy students in everything, but they don't know unless you ask. And so you have to just put yourself out there. And if they say no, you'll find another opportunity.
Yeah, I would echo both those things. I would also say from my personal story, like, don't hesitate to, you know, leverage or call upon the skills that you have learned in other areas to show how you would be a good person to work in neurology. Because like we said, you might not have that PGY2. I think there's only 2 accredited and 2 maybe seeking accreditation as far as PGY2s in neurology. So, but you can really use leadership skills, relationship building skills, everything that you learned in other areas to apply to neurology. And some of that practical knowledge you get by studying and learning as you go. So we would welcome anyone who wants to join us working in this space. It's a really great area. With that, I think that's all the time we have for that part of our discussion. I really enjoyed hearing your guys' stories, a little that I knew and a little that I didn't. And your insights. I hope you're both planning to save this recording in a time capsule for your future generations, so everyone knows how cool pharmacy is. And next, we'll get into the meat of the discussion for today. Now to get into the big topic of the day, the recent AAN meeting. So AAN, or the American Academy of Neurology, has an absolutely humongous annual meeting every spring that is called the Academy meeting, although with no Academy Awards, as far as I know. I feel like that is maybe a crossover that should be explored in the future, but as of right now, no. But this is, I'm going to say huge multiple times because it's a huge meeting in size, but also in impact, with a lot of late-breaking abstracts and truly the newest data being presented. Like, I literally asked a drug rep a specific question like a month ago, and they told me, hold on that thought, we're actually presenting on that at AAN. Like, they couldn't tell me because they wanted to present it at AAN. And in all transparency, none of the three of us were at AAN this year, which I feel like is just a normal thing, right? You can't go to every meeting, whether it be due to financial restrictions or not being able to get away from work for that long, or maybe you have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old who's still not sleeping through the night, and you couldn't possibly leave your partner alone with all that for 5+ days. And that is just a hypothetical scenario, obviously. Whatever the reason, though, we luckily live in an age where we can and definitely should try to stay up to date on the new research and updates that come out of these meetings whenever we can. And so we are here to review some of those things today, so you don't have to do all the work yourself. And again, with that disclaimer, AAN is huge, and so we had to choose, and by that I use my executive power here to choose some select things from a huge 5-day meeting to distill into this short podcast. So with that, the first topic we're going to discuss is Mycenae, because it has frankly blown up in recent years and deserves its share of time. I'm going to ask Sarah to lead us off here, since we have, you know, probably some listeners that are not as familiar with every area of neurology and might not be as familiar with myasthenia. Can you give us a super brief overview of the disease state and just generally how it's treated from the outpatient clinic side?
Sure. Thanks, Erica. We definitely see a lot of myasthenia gravis patients because we're a referral center. So just to review briefly, myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune disorder, and the autoimmune attack happens at the neuromuscular junction. So that's where the nerve is meeting the muscle. And there is decreased conduction through that junction, and it leads to fluctuating motor weakness. So it's not fixed. It's not there all the time. It's fluctuating. There might be episodes of weakness that then relent. The muscles that are primarily involved are ocular, bulbar, limb, and then at worst, respiratory muscles. And so the treatment for symptomatic treatment, which some patients may just need symptomatic treatment, those would be really lucky patients. And they will be taking pyridostigmine to increase the cholinergic transmission through the neuromuscular junction. But a lot of patients need some type of immunosuppressive in addition to that. And so for those patients, it's typically going to start with prednisone. And obviously, we don't want people to be on prednisone high doses for a long time. So we often start non-steroidal immunosuppressive therapies that are oral, such as azathioprine or mycophenolate. See if that is able to maintain a minimal expression of the myasthenia gravis symptoms. If that doesn't work, we may add additional IVIG as a maintenance therapy. It can be used for rescue therapy too, but we'll add it as a routine scheduled maintenance therapy. And then beyond that, of course, patients are evaluated for a thymectomy, whether they have a thymoma or not. And then after that, we get into more of the exotic therapies,
which we'll talk about some of those and how they're adding to maybe our treatment repertoire in a little bit. But Tyler, it's not uncommon for what we call a myasthenic crisis to bring a patient into the hospital. Can you give us an overview of our current treatment approaches from an inpatient side?
Absolutely. Actually, about 20% of the patients that are diagnosed with myasthenia gravis will actually present it with a myasthenic crisis when they first are diagnosed. And so there is a particularly high risk of crisis within the first year after being diagnosed. So many of these patients come to the hospital and require ICU level care. And in severe cases, we actually provide mechanical ventilation. From an inpatient standpoint, our initial treatment approach follows established standards of care, which is typically plasma exchange or IVIG. We consider them interchangeable. Our institution, for the most part, will favor plasma exchange in most cases. And then we pair that with corticosteroids. So we'll do high-dose methylprednisolone and then start them on a steroid taper to follow up outpatient. Things become more challenging when patients don't respond adequately to corticosteroids or our traditional immunosuppressants, or they even fail first-line monoclonal antibody therapies, and they still present in crisis and we're forced to escalate therapy in the inpatient setting. And that's when we get into agents like rituximab, eculizumab, and even cyclophosphamide sometimes.
Thanks, Tyler. Yes, so much growth in generalized myasthenia, like I mentioned. Most recently was the approval of inebilizumab, which is a CD19-targeted B-cell therapy that was approved in December of 2025. So some cool research, a whole panel with abstracts presented at AAN in this space. Regarding inebilizumab, they did have an abstract, which was the 52-week analysis of the initial phase 3 MINT trial that did get inebilizumab approved. And I don't think we saw any surprises there. Just targeted depletion of B cells and durable improvement in particularly the acetylcholine receptor positive generalized myasthenia population. through week 52 on that inebilizumab treatment. And I don't think we're surprised by that necessarily, because we do have the history of using rituximab, a different B-cell depleter that targets CD20 in this population. And like I mentioned, inebilizumab also has FDA approval for other indications, one of those being neuromyelitis optica, another neurologic disease. And so that's a disease state I see a bunch in my clinic. And so we have had that discussion play out of, do you use the new FDA approved option or do you use the older option, rituximab, which doesn't have those large-scale phase 3 trials necessarily, but does have a cost-effective biosimilar available now. So I'm interested, Sarah, still kind of early days for inebilizumab in generalized myasthenia, but are you seeing that discussion play out in clinic at all?
Yeah, it's come up once so far, and so I do think it's going to become a more common conversation.
Awesome, guys. Great overview.
I think we're seeing that a lot. It's
been
kind of
so much growth,
you know,
in generalized myasthenia treatment.
It's important to keep in mind, you know, of
having that FcRn blocker, you know, complement inhibitors, but and use of CD20 therapies,
some
like
programs for patients to be a part
of. Most recently, we had the approval of inebilizumab, which was
is a CD19 targeted B-cell
therapy
that was approved
is
in December of 2025.
Inebilizumab has
other indications previous to that.
Yeah,
but
we're definitely going to see more of those discussions in December,
probably both of these spaces.
So, needless to say, some cool research was presented at AAN.
Moving on,
in
we also
space,
saw the phase 3 results.
Our first abstract that we'll discuss was regarding
inebilizumab.
We had a 52-week analysis of the initial phase 3 MINT trial that got the drug approved for this indication.
Geferulimab is a subcutaneous weekly C5 complement inhibitor, which, if approved, would join the space with fellow IV complement inhibitors, eculizumab and ravulizumab, as well as the daily subcutaneous injection zilucoplan. So I think this could offer at-home convenience for patients. But since that mechanism is really pretty firmly established in generalized myasthenia at this point, I don't think we need to spend time on this trial. We can move on to different things. What could be interesting, though, still in the complement space, is the potential for clasiprubart. Would anyone have a different suggestion?
I'd say that was fantastic.
Okay. I think I'm just not going to say that drug name anymore, and you just know that I'm referencing that one. So we saw positive phase 2 results from presented at AAN this year. This new drug, again, is targeting the complement pathway, but it's selective in inhibiting only the active form of the C1s protein. So while we still need phase 3 results, which, as we know, is probably, you know, at least maybe a year away, given how things work and how long things take for these large-scale clinical trials, the manufacturer's ultimate goal is to seek approval for this drug without an included black box warning or REMS program for serious meningococcal infections. Now, currently, this black box and REMS program is required for all of our other complement inhibitors in this space. So that could be really nice for initiation and, of course, to mitigate that risk for patients. And so more to come on that, but we'll definitely be watching that space. And let's see. Let's move on now to some time on CAR-T therapy, which honestly I feel like is being explored for so many things in neurology and also beyond. But we had a couple abstracts on CAR-T therapy for myasthenia presented at this academy meeting. So the aim here is essentially an immune system reset. And that's a lot of what I know about CAR-T therapy summed up. So what does CAR-T actually involve? Now, since at least for now, and I think for a while, this is going to be just an inpatient treatment. And I think at our institution, we've honestly only used it for cancer diagnoses so far. But can you talk about anything you know about CAR-T, Tyler, from the inpatient side, or any talk of that at all?
Sure. I can tell you what I think I know. The CAR-T therapy, it's really a fundamentally different approach compared to our traditional immunosuppression. And you're right, it's being explored across neurology and a lot of other disease states with the idea of creating something close to an immune system reset. So at a high level, CAR-T involves using the patient's own immune cells. T cells are collected through an apheresis procedure and then sent to a specialized laboratory where they're re-engineered to express the chimeric antigen receptor, which is the CAR, on their surface. These modified cells are expanded and then they infuse them back into the patient to target specific components of the immune response. Because of how complex the process is, initiating CAR-T requires a fair amount of planning. So before cell collection even happens, patients have to undergo a extensive pre-treatment evaluation that includes baseline cardiac workup, detailed neurologic exam, inflammatory markers, and infectious disease screening. And then after cell collection, patients actually receive lympho-depleting chemotherapy with agents like cyclophosphamide to create space for the CAR-T cells to function effectively. So after they do that, then the patient can be admitted to the hospital to actually receive the CAR-T infusion. And from there, patients have to stay in the hospital for about 7 to 14 days, I think, on average, depending on how they tolerate the therapy and whether or not complications arise. And then even after discharge, they have to stay within a close driving distance to the hospital that took care of them for up to 30 days because of risk of potentially life-threatening toxicities. And so historically, CAR-T, yes, it's in the oncology space, but we do have the inpatient infrastructure and the monitoring requirements and the coordination in place, which makes it interesting to use in the future from a neurologic standpoint.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you for that overview, because I really didn't have that knowledge. Obviously, that would take some serious logistics. You know, sometimes I'm glad that's when sometimes Huntsman, or that's our oncology institution here, sometimes they take the reins on some things and we're able to gain knowledge from that. That would be awesome. But you had mentioned some serious toxicity. So what big risks does CAR-T have?
Yeah, so logistics are one challenge, but the other major considerations really center around safety. The biggest risk with CAR-T is inflammatory toxicities, particularly cytokine release syndrome, or CRS. And there's also ICANS, which is a neurotoxicity syndrome. And those complications are ones we monitor for early. And they're a big reason therapy still requires inpatient administration with extensive monitoring. And then beyond that, there are other important risks. Patients develop significant cytopenias, anemia, thrombocytopenia, and those prolong hospital stays. And there's also an increased risk of infection, given the degree of immune system manipulation. That being said, which really is exciting, especially from the abstracts that they presented, is that even though the patient numbers were very small, I think one study just did 6 patients, the signal was meaningful. These early studies, about half the patients showed a dramatic improvement from their baseline, which is remarkable given how refractory these cases were going into the study. So I think we're going to continue to see this approach going forward, explored in myasthenia specifically and other neurologic diseases.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. We definitely have to weigh, you know, those significant toxicity risks against our current treatment options and the potential benefits and convenience CAR-T does offer, you know, potentially this one and done treatment option for severe patients. And that would appeal to a lot of people, I think. And the idea that it's strong enough to help those severe patients who have maybe failed or refractory to some of our more standard things, you know, so it could have a niche. I definitely believe that. Sarah, what's the feeling among providers right now about this, recognizing that we, of course, have data in less than a dozen patients based on these abstracts alone?
I would pick one word, anticipation. For our really refractory patients, just as you both really well described, when we've tried everything or the patient isn't appropriate for everything, this is something that we're very much anticipating as an option to help reduce hospital visits, inpatient stays for myasthenic crises. And so we've even had talks about, like, can the patients get in the clinical trials for CAR-T MG? And so it's something that we've been talking about for probably the last year and are waiting with bated breath.
Fair enough. Before we move on from myasthenia, I want to discuss efgartigimod, which is one of our FcRn blockers. There were a couple abstracts here, both taking a look at using efgartigimod for what I would call non-standard situations.
The first, taking a look at results in generalized myasthenia patients, aiming to review long-term outcomes, treatment patterns, and predictors of efficacy. You know, knowing this isn't the full publication, but what were their major takeaways here, Sarah?
I actually was able to find the full article, so I went ahead and reviewed that so that I would have context to present to the audience, just because that's how my brain works. So let me give you the title. It's called The Real-World Outcomes of Efgartigimod in ACHR-Positive Generalized Myasthenia Gravis, Response Patterns, Predictors, and Treatment Strategies. And when I was searching this, there's actually several articles that came up in this similar with a similar title. So I'm glad we're looking at real world use of this medication. For this particular study, they looked at, as I mentioned, ACHR positive only patients. So not MuSK positive, not seronegative patients. And they had to have at least a 2 on one item of their MG-ADL score. And my interpretation of that is they could be actually not have a very severe MG-ADL score. For other trials that I looked at, the baseline MG-ADL score was like 9. So if you just had to have a 2 on one of the sections, that means you may not have as severe of a disease, at least in my interpretation. And when I looked at the results, the mean MG-ADL score was 7, so lower than a lot of the other trials that I looked at. So they were able to enroll 46 adult patients. And the primary endpoint was to look at the improvement in MG-ADL score and the achievement of minimal symptom expression. And the secondary endpoints that they looked at were decrease in prednisone dose and successful bridging, which is something we talk about in clinic sometimes, trying to get something on board that works more quickly. While we're waiting for like an oral immunosuppressive to kick in. But those were only secondary endpoints, so I'm going to stick with the primary endpoints. And essentially, they in this study, they had 46 patients, and 39 of the patients had at least 12 months of follow-up. So that's a nice sample size. And the mean interval between cycles of efgartigimod, which just to remind you, efgartigimod is usually given once weekly for 4 weeks, and then anywhere from 4 to 12 weeks in between the next cycle. It was first approved on demand. So when patient symptoms got worse, they would call in and then we would order another cycle. And so I think that one of the values of this abstract and of this study is they're helping us see in the real world what that actually looks like. Because the mean interval between treatment cycles was 9.8 weeks. And so that is certainly good information. And most recently, the labeling was changed so that it can be given one infusion every 4 weeks, 4 weeks off, and then restart a new cycle. So I think that's good context because they showed in this study that patients overall may have a really good response with that first cycle based on the numbers, but they didn't maintain that through the next cycle. They had kind of this diminishing returns unless the patient received the drug again. So I think that's one of the values, is that this gave us some real world data that definitely corroborates with what I'm seeing in clinic. And I also noticed that patients may achieve MSE, or minimally symptomatic expression, but they didn't necessarily stay there. So those were my takeaways. 11 patients of the 20 patients that discontinued therapy. So there were 20 patients that stopped drugs. Almost half of the patients stopped the drug during the trial. 11 of them, it was due to insufficient efficacy. So I think that's also really important that patients may get started on this medication, but when you're watching them for a year, a lot of patients may discontinue or they may have an incomplete or unsustained response.
Thanks. Thanks for that analysis, Sarah. That was great. So you had mentioned that some really good response with that first cycle of treatment, you know, and the idea of potentially using this as a bridge to some of our older kind of standard immunosuppressants. So, and that's really interesting because it could have some inpatient implications. You know, plasma exchange is expensive. Efgartigimod is expensive. You know, there could, you know, I've seen FcRn inhibitors be compared to plasma exchange, and it could be have some implications there. Do you think there could be a future role for inpatient use of one of these agents, Tyler, or stick with what we know right now?
I do think there's potentially a role for the FcRn inhibitors in the inpatient space, but probably not in the way we kind of think about managing a myasthenic crisis when they come into the hospital. The main limitation right now is timing for efgartigimod. We don't really see peak IgG reduction until around 4 weeks is why we do the 4 week treatment. But and then newer agents are as close to 2 weeks, but because of that delay, they're unlikely to replace our urgent or emergent plasma exchange or IVIG therapies in patients who are acutely decompensating. That said, I do think these agents are really interesting in the patients who are hospitalized with less severe disease, who are improving but still need a longer-term strategy. So in that setting, the FcRn inhibitors could give us an opportunity to reduce corticosteroid exposure during hospitalization and start more targeted therapy earlier, something that ultimately may be comparable to plasma exchange in the end, but potentially a better safety profile. Another advantage is that unlike the complement inhibitors, the FcRn inhibitors don't come with the same vaccination requirements on the inpatient setting. That always complicates things on discharge for me. And then, but still, the biggest barrier right now for inpatient use is still going to be cost. I think the last number I saw for efgartigimod was approaching $450,000 a year for drug therapy, which makes widespread inpatient adoption a challenge. But as we get more data, particularly studies looking at these drugs as a bridge to the traditional immunosuppressants, I think we may see a more clear and more practical inpatient role emerge.
Yeah, definitely important things to consider there. The other efgartigimod abstract was for acetylcholine receptor antibody seronegative myasthenia, which is a mouthful, but it's a really important discussion topic and really kind of ending our myasthenia discussion with a bang here, because having a study in seronegative myasthenia is really important because newer biologic therapies are not approved in this subset of patients, and therefore treatment options right now are really limited. What did you think about this one, Sarah?
So I thought this was interesting as well. I was able to get the full study for this, so I looked at that to bring up some highlights for our viewers. So this was, it's called the ADAPT-SERON study. And what they did is they wanted to evaluate the efficacy and safety of efgartigimod. And both this and the last study that I mentioned were only IV. Remember, efgartigimod is available in sub-Q. So I think that's an important distinction. So this is the IV only. And they looked at patients that were quote unquote seronegative. But what that means is they were acetylcholine receptor or ACHR antibody negative. They could have MuSK positive antibodies. They could have LRP4 antibodies, which, and then they could be triple negative. So truly, you are doing the antibody tests and none of them come back positive. So three different types of patients were enrolled in this study. And they had two different arms. The first arm was only 8 weeks. It was double-blind, placebo-controlled, and they randomized patients to, of course, the once-weekly for 4 weeks, and then they followed them for another 5 weeks. And so that was the first arm. The second arm was an open-label extension where they followed these patients for 2 years. And overall, I was impressed with how many patients they were able to get, because these are definitely rarer patients with these types of antibodies. They had 119 participants, 40 of them were MuSK positive, 6 were LRP4 positive, and 73 were triple seronegative. And they looked at the change in MG-ADL score from baseline to week 4. That was the primary endpoint. And the primary endpoint did favor efgartigimod over placebo in patients that were MuSK positive. Their mean I think it was like least squared mean difference, decreased by 3.35 in the MuSK positive. And then in the triple negative patients, there was no difference. So overall, I think that this showed that at least at 4 weeks, efgartigimod can be helpful with patients with MuSK positive myasthenia gravis. And then I forgot to mention that the patients with LRP4 antibodies, it reduced their least squared mean MG-ADL. MG-ADL by 4 points, which is pretty impressive. So it worked for those two groups. For the triple negative patients, which are notoriously hard to treat, to be honest, there wasn't a big difference. So I'm not sure that we're going to see an uptake in those patients. And interestingly, it has been submitted to the FDA so that efgartigimod may be approved for seronegative patients based on this data. And that PDUFA date, we should hear back in mid-May, maybe by the 10th.
Well, unfortunate for those triple negative patients, but I believe this would be the first one with the LRP4 approval. Is that right, Sarah?
Yes.
So that would be cool. Still a win. We got to focus on the wins. And I feel like overall, these FcRn inhibitors are popping up in a lot of different spaces, so they may be a class to watch. I've seen trials for looking at these medications for use in a lot of other IgG-mediated diseases in rheumatology and dermatology, which makes sense. But also, like, I was watching a Lerner report the other day, and there was, like, a random study for proof of concept in fibromyalgia for one of these drugs. So, you know, so we'll definitely talk about these medications again as more data comes out in these this kind of vast arena here. Next, I want to shift to two disorders that currently have no FDA-approved treatment options: myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein antibody-associated disease. Gosh, really not doing ourselves any favors here with the things we have to say. Also known as MOGAD, and stiff person syndrome. So both of these disease states were highlighted at the AAN meeting with treatment trials, which is really exciting. So we'll start briefly with stiff person syndrome, since it actually has a bit of overlap from our previous discussion. For those who aren't familiar, stiff person syndrome is a rare neurologic disorder characterized by progressive muscle stiffness and painful spasms, often affecting the trunk and the limbs and leading to difficulty with movement and posture, sometimes even difficulty breathing with some diaphragmatic spasms if patients have those. It's believed to be an autoimmune condition where the pathways involving the neurotransmitter GABA are disrupted. So symptoms can worsen with triggers like stress, and they may gradually increase in severity over time. Current therapy right now is two-pronged: symptomatic therapy with things like benzodiazepines and other muscle relaxants, and immunotherapy, usually with IVIG being our first-line option for these patients. So that's just kind of your really 30,000-foot view of stiff person syndrome. At the AAN, we had an abstract, which was a small phase 2 trial with 26 patients that, again, took a look at CAR-T, anti-CD19 CAR-T therapy, just a single dose in stiff person patients. So this was a positive trial, but I must admit I do have a few concerns about this study, and I do think I see the stiff persons most often in my practice, so I'll just kind of say what my concerns are. So one, kind of the primary one, is the use of a timed 25-foot walk as the primary endpoint in this trial. They did show a statistically significant improvement in this outcome. But, you know, while this is a standard outcome in something like multiple sclerosis and one that is generally measured at every visit in that population, it's actually not something that we measure in our stiff person patients in clinic right now. So I think personally, it's hard to know the significance of the change. I would really not think that my clinic is probably behind the times, and it's, this is probably a question that a lot of clinics, as they see this data, are coming up, and maybe we'll do the time 25-foot walk now in the future. But you know, it's hard to know how to interpret the results without knowing kind of the standards in this population for a time 25-foot walk. So, you know, at the same time, what is the best endpoint in a rare disease like this that doesn't have any FDA-approved therapies?
So I'd love to know, guys, if this has happened for you guys in other rare diseases, you know, how would you approach a data set like that?
I guess I wouldn't dismiss it right away. I think that the study did show that there was consistent improvement across multiple secondary endpoints. They did the modified rank scale, stiffness indices, and height sensitivity measures. So you see improvement across several relevant measures. That strengthens the trial, especially in a small phase two trial. I think it's important not to fixate on the number of seconds that were shaved off the walk test, but about what it represented from a functionality standpoint for patients, and that it did provide aid-free ambulation in some of those patients, which is a tangible outcome. So in rare diseases like stiff persons, I don't think we don't have a perfectly validated score, but early trials are also about proof of concept as they are about meaningful improvement.
Yeah, totally good points, and a really good opportunity to take a look at secondary endpoints and see the implications to patient quality of life. Absolutely, because this is something where symptoms are severely limit a quality of life in some of these patients. Has that come up for you, Sarah? I know you see, you know, some of these cognitive studies in the beginning, that was an issue, right?
Yeah, I think finding the right endpoint can be very elusive, and especially I see this in neurodegenerative disorders where you try to describe a very complicated patient experience, but in a studyable way. So I do understand the challenge that the study authors had. It would have been nice if they'd looked at falls or something subjective like patient experience. I don't remember if they review patient experience or subjective information, but that seems to be an important part of the SPS literature as well.
Yeah, I'll definitely be looking for this full publication to take a little closer look. The other thing that was brought up by a different expert in a commentary that we can link to in the show notes, but the idea that CAR T requires kind of this full lymphodepletion prior to even doing the CAR T treatment. And we know that kind of lymphodepletion can be helpful in a lot of stiff person patients. So the comment there was, you know, unclear what degree of improvement is due to the initial lymphodepletion versus the CAR T therapy itself. So again, a reason to look more at this space, look deeper at the publication when we see the full results. But just a really exciting trial to gain exposure to this rare disease and to a disease that doesn't have any approved therapies right now. So still positive overall to have that exposure. And now we're going to move on to another rare disease. So MOG, or that myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein antibody associated disease. Kind of a rare neurologic disorder. This is a demyelinating disease. It's an autoimmune disorder of the central nervous system. Antibodies are targeting the myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, that MOG, which is a protein on the surface of myelin-producing cells. If that description immediately makes you think of MS, you're not alone. It shares features, and especially throughout history, could have been easily misdiagnosed as MS. But we are targeting specifically MOG here, and we can test for a MOG antibody. MOGAD is a distinct disease at this point, and it definitely has different immunologic mechanisms, imaging findings, and also treatments. These patients do not generally respond to MS treatments. Now, Tyler, you would often meet a MOG patient, sometimes inpatient, before they ever meet me in outpatient care. So how might a MOG patient present, and what kind of treatments might a patient get while they're inpatient?
Sure. Most of the time, I see adult patients. So when we meet new MOG-associated disease in the hospital and we're diagnosing them, they're presenting with new vision loss. And that means a number of things, but we're able to quickly make the diagnosis of optic neuritis based on their clinical exam, MRI findings, and their CSF samples. We also see a subset of patients that come in with the transverse myelitis. And those cases can be a bit more complex because there's a broader differential. But a lot of that inpatient workup is focused on ruling out other inflammatory or infectious or structural causes before we land on MOG as our driver of the disease. But from a treatment standpoint, the inpatient management is pretty straightforward. The standard therapy is high-dose IV methylprednisolone. We do 1,000 milligrams daily for 5 days, followed by the oral prednisone taper. We start at 60 milligrams daily. And most patients respond well to steroids alone, and then we send them to the outpatient for more definitive treatment. I'd say the majority of MOG patients that I see do not need escalation to plasma exchange or IVIG during their initial hospitalization. And we usually reserve those decisions for more severe or steroid refractory cases. And those are usually made later.
Awesome. And on the outpatient side, once we receive a patient in clinic post-discharge, based on current literature, we are treating with IVIG in most patients. At AAN, we had phase 3 trial results from the METEOROID trial, and this looked specifically at the use of satralizumab, which is an IL-6 blocker in relapsing MOGAD. This medication is already approved for aquaporin-4-positive NMOSD, but at least in our clinic, it doesn't have a ton of the market share in that population. Now, in MOGAD, this study, the METEOROID study, did meet its primary endpoint, showing a 68% reduced risk for a new MOGAD relapse compared with those receiving placebo, and a greater percentage of the group also remained relapse-free at 48 weeks. Now, I think the important distinction here is that this was used in relapsing MOGAD patients, because there's a lot of recent discussion on MOGAD and whether it should be considered primarily a monophasic course with just a single event and potentially not needing this chronic immunotherapy, or whether it should be considered a primary relapsing course similar to something like MS or NMOSD. A different study presented at AN actually looked at this, attempting to determine relapse risk among incident MOGAD patients. So this was in the Kaiser system. It followed 69 patients for 6 years. So given a rare disease, this is a pretty good sample set. They found only 3 or 10% of their pediatric cases and 5 or a percentage of 12.8% of their adult patients relapsed. Things they noticed, relapses occurred shortly after symptom onset with a median of 2.8 months. And the authors concluded that the overall relapse risk in MOGAD is low, and empiric prophylactic therapy is not indicated for all new onset MOGAD patients. So that's potentially a really big topic. So, I know out of the three of us, outpatient MOGAD treatment is primarily my area. And so, my thought on this is we have a lot of thinking to do. Now, we were historically putting all patients on IVIG, if possible, thinking that we were preventing relapses in all patients. And we have started to consider peeling this off after a period of maybe 2 years on immunotherapy. But, I think the providers are going to have a lot to consider going forward as we determine which patients to treat and which not to treat. I think it's really important to think about the patient perspective here as we undergo new research as well. What are you guys' thoughts on that from the patient perspective? Do you have anything, Tyler?
I think that doesn't have a ton of implication for the inpatient setting right now, but it would be it'd be good to have an improved treatment for that subset of relapsing patients. Since those can be scary and a full recovery is likely as high, but it's not a guaranteed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are going to be some really big discussions with patients to come out of this. Yeah, finally, since these drugs are absolutely everywhere right now, I want to review a couple studies looking at GLP-1 agents that were presented at AAN. So tell me the truth, guys. How many of the patients that come through your practice areas are on one of the GLP-1s for either diabetes, weight management, or an off-label indication? How much are you seeing this inpatient?
I think anecdotally, I would say it's a significant chunk of our patients, maybe like 25% of them, are either currently on a GLP-1 or have at least been prescribed one at some point. So that includes their use for diabetes, for weight loss, or sometimes even for off-label indications. And then support and include, I see patients who have it on their medication list who almost end up on therapy. They get a prescription, but they never start because of cost or access issues. And so that's another percentage of our population.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. What about you, Sarah?
I think just to kind of add to what Tyler said, on the outpatient basis, I would say at least 50% of my patients have it on their list. And when I look at whether they're filling it or not, that's a whole nother story. So I think a lot of most everyone's heard about them. A lot have been prescribed. Some have started. Many have stopped.
Yeah. And some for various reasons.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and I think we'll continue to see that trend. My experience has been about the same. I think in any space that you work in, we're all going to get more and more questions about using these medications, but especially in the neurology space, they've come up quite a bit. For right now, being honest, my clinic tries to not be the actual prescriber of them. Honestly, getting them off-label is really quite difficult. Even getting them on-label is sometimes difficult with certain insurances, so I do feel like that may change in the future, but for right now, I'm happy to not have us prescribing this. We do have studies with GLP-1s in three different disease states to review here. So I think we're each going to take one. Sarah, can you start us off with just this brief discussion of this? The abstract was called GLP-1 receptor agonists versus SGLT2 inhibitors and the risk of Alzheimer's disease and type 2 diabetes. A systematic review and meta-analysis.
Sure. So I think the title gives you a great description of what the trial does. They looked at all of the studies that they could find that met their criteria. And they wanted, it was case control studies as well as one randomized control trial. So 15 studies met their inclusion criteria, and only one was a randomized controlled trial. So I think that tells us a lot about the rigor of and what we have and what patients have access to as well. So essentially, they looked at patients that were prescribed. Well, I don't even know if it says prescribed. They compared patients with GLP-1s and or SGLT2s. So Farxiga or empagliflozin.
Thank you for sharing the burden of the pronunciations here.
Exactly. The ozins, for those of you who had to look it up like I did. And so the patients had to be on that for diabetes. And then they essentially looked at whether they had Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And they calculated hazard ratios for that. They had some secondary endpoints, which I, for the sake of time, I'll skip. So essentially, they did a regression analysis to see if any of the variables could explain what they got. The primary endpoint, patients that were on GLP-1 receptor agonists or SGLT2s consistently demonstrated, at least in this trial, a reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease because the hazard ratio was 0.84 with a confidence interval that did not include one. And it also had a reduced risk of other types of dementia, hazard ratio of 0.8. And this was when compared to other glucose-lowering therapies. So it seems like these two therapies, at least based on this trial, might be superior if we're thinking about Alzheimer's disease or dementia prevention in the future, because we know patients with diabetes have an increased risk of developing both of those morbidities. And so from that, and doing a quick search, there are many studies out here like this. And so I feel like based on the literature that we have, we're in the phase of we mainly have retrospective literature. We might have some prospective case-controlled studies. We're really short on randomized controlled trials. I would like to see that change. When I did a quick MUBPED, you know.
Have you not heard of that resource?
Exactly. It's the newer version. Yeah. It's incognito.
The cool kids.
When I did a quick search, I found that there are a lot of people publishing on the trial designs they would like to see for GLP-1s in dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And so I think we'll start to see those being published or being produced if they can get the funding.
Okay, so probably though, don't need to run out and prescribe a GLP-1 for anyone with concerns for dementia right now.
I don't think so, based on, because there are other studies that showed there was no difference.
Okay.
So.
All right. Fair enough. Tyler, now I know that you are an inpatient person, but we have this other SGLT2 comparison with primary prevention of stroke, tirzepatide versus these SGLT2 inhibitors. You know about strokes a little bit, so maybe you can comment on that for us.
Yeah, this study is interesting. Mainly it's because it's a head-to-head comparison, which we don't see very often, especially outside of our placebo-controlled cardiovascular outcome trials. So that alone makes it worth paying attention to. The SGLT2s inhibitors clearly have a strong evidence for heart failure and renal protection. So I don't think this study changes their role in those populations. When it comes to stroke, though, prior cardiovascular outcome trials with SGLT2s have either shown modest benefit or neutral effect. So they're never really been thought of as a strong stroke preventative agent. GLP-1 based therapies and tirzepatide in particular raise a different question. These drugs have favorable effects on weight reduction, blood pressure, and lipid profiles, which makes us wonder if there's a degree of neurovascular protection that goes beyond glycemic control alone. That said, it's important that to frame this study appropriately, it is observational and it's not randomized, and it specifically excluded patients with a prior stroke or TIA, so the findings are really limited to primary prevention, and we should be cautious about extrapolating them to patients with established cerebrovascular disease. It suggests that there may be differences between the drug classes when it comes to stroke risk, but answering that definitively is going to require a dedicated stroke trial.
Yeah, I think they're really almost like trying to pit these two drug classes against each other. I don't know where the beef is, but thank you for that summary. I agree with your summary completely. And my abstract took a look at migraine. So, and to specify here, we're talking about chronic migraine because there has already been a fair amount of research in using GLP-1s for idiopathic intracranial hypertension associated headaches already. Well, not as much in the chronic migraine space. So that's what this abstract looked at. And it looked at GLP-1s versus topiramate, which is a very standard preventative for chronic migraine in terms of such things as healthcare utilization, triptan use, and preventive treatment escalation. It was a cohort study, and it did have some large numbers, about 11,000 patients in each group. You know, which if that doesn't tell you how big of a problem chronic migraine is in the population, I don't know what does. So their results were largely positive in this cohort study, a lower relative risk of ED visits, hospitalizations, and triptan use, which were statistically significant, as well as on the side of preventive treatment escalation, a lower relative risk for initiation of other preventives, such as TCAs, CGRP agents, SNRIs, and valproate, which why anyone wants to use that, I don't know. But no significant differences specifically in beta blocker initiation, which is another really common chronic migraine preventive. Now, I would, of course, like to see the full publication to look at the data some more, but I do agree with the authors here that there could be a role based on this for GLP-1s in migraine management. Now, there is some thought that GLP-1s do have some effect, you know, in like nociceptive pathways. So that could be kind of a primary target for its use in migraine management. And this was a comparison to topiramate. So we do have to imagine if you were to do maybe a rigorous prospective trial for GLP-1s in this space, that there could be significant improvements to be had for chronic migraine patients. And this could offer a new mechanism that we could potentially even layer or safely add on to some of our best therapies like CGRP agents. So it could be another tool in the space and in kind of the battle against migraine, which is, you know, the leading cause of disability in a lot of our young patients. So with that, I think we are going to end a really excellent discussion. Thank you guys so much. Obviously, like I said, we cannot possibly review the entire conference in this podcast, but I know that we have covered some really important and potentially practice-changing updates today. I want to be sure to end each podcast with a little work-life balance because that's really important for all of us. And because I'm in my, you know, staycation, afraid to stay in a small hotel room with two toddlers on different sleep schedules era,
I want to know the coolest place that you guys have visited recently, which honestly could be a restaurant down the street or some faraway land. I promise either will be exotic to me at this point in my life. So I know Sarah well. She always shares her adventures with me, which I love. So I'm going to ask you to share first, Sarah.
Yeah, when I was thinking about this, I was like, where have I been recently? And then I think this is particularly important because I feel responsible for helping create a TV show. So in January, I went to West Yellowstone to go cross-country skiing, as I do most years. It's a beautiful place. And this year, my friend and I decided to take a different trail that goes along the river. And the name of the river is the Madison River. And I don't know, for those of you who are in the Yellowstone verse, there's a new show dropping that is called The Madison, and it is that river. So check it out. I think it has Michelle Pfeiffer in it. And I feel like I helped make that happen and materialize.
That's right. I wouldn't be surprised if we see you.
Exactly. Spotlighted. I could be. Exactly.
What about you, Tyler?
Yeah, so instead of going to AAN, I spent my spring break in Puerto Rico, which was a good reset. Gosh. So good, I did all the standard beach food and being outside. But this highlight of the trip was actually a professional basketball game. So Puerto Rico has a 12-team league with some solid talent. Some of it's former NBA players, some are international players. But we crammed into this 5,000-seat arena with all the locals and cheered on our San Germán Atléticos.
That
and
is
and they won.
Awesome.
It was very loud.
And they win.
That's so cool.
It was very loud. It was very fun.
Yeah.
That sounds so fun. One of our providers, their sister lives in Puerto Rico on this kind of off-grid farm situation. And she goes there a lot. And I'm always jealous. And I feel like I'm like, you know, maybe a solid year of friendship away from an ask. Megan, have you heard this? thank you, guys. Thanks for ending with a bang. With that, we have reached the end of episode one. Again, thank you, guys. Can't thank you enough for being here, being such excellent guests and, you know, excellent spokespeople for neurology. And for everyone listening, I hope we have made lifelong listeners and neurology enthusiasts out of you all after just one episode. My gosh, are we amazing? Tune in monthly for more episodes of Mind the Meds, and have a great day, week, month.